The token is a minority that has been deliberately put on a television show or in a work environment for the sake of being culturally diverse. It is in all truths a ruse for what it's supposed to represent. It gives a false sense of inclusion to the outside world. This show is a discussion on issues affecting those communities. Here, the token is used as a symbol for a discussion on the effects of culture and class on the token's health, wealth, nutrition, and overall quality of life. On this episode, I talk with Dead Prez. They're known for their confrontational style combined with socialist lyrics focused on both militant social justice and Pan-Africanism. The duo maintains an ethical stance against corporate control over the media, especially hip-hop record labels. We begin our conversation with Matulu, M1 of Dead Prez. Later on, Stickman, the other half of Dead Prez, calls in and joins us to talk about RBG Fit Club, their initiative to involve the community in getting healthy together. But I start my conversation with Matulu with a discussion on culture, identity, and the naming process. Matulu Alugbala, that's a very unique name. What does it mean, and how did you come to receive that name?
When people ask that question, you know, a lot of times I think we have to, like, re-identify what names are to ourselves. So we carry on namesakes from our parents and our communities. But what's also passed down is that legacy and that heritage of what came with that name. And as we all know, we Africans who were brought here to America to build America were given the names of our oppressor. So, of course, that is similar to the name that was given to me, which my mother and father came into the same kind of consciousness about as okay. I did, because it was like a forced thing. We learned through a cohesive experience, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or a composite experience. So, basically, you know, I changed my name given to me by my community, which was a revolutionary community, which was a community that was informed by our movement, our revolutionary movement from years and years before me. And I was given the namesake of my mentor, whose name is Mutulu Shakur, who
okay.
was also a revolutionary, a fighting force in the Black Liberation Movement, and was one of the most notable Black Panther Party members in the New York chapter of Black Panther Party. And many people also know him as the stepfather, godfather for Tupac Shakur as well.
Yeah.
For me, you know, the carrying on the name Mutulu is a responsibility that I don't take lightly, and that my mother has also and other members of my family, my revolutionary family, have united with me on that experience around. So that's kind of how I was named. You know, we continue to get names all through life. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
all the way from son to grandma. You know, at the end of the day, you know, they call you grandma. They don't even call you your name. You're just granny or grandma or nana or whatever you are. But these are all parts of who we are. And as I've learned in African tradition, these are parts of the names that I've carried forth. I also got named since I was named that as I've moved through countries and continents like Africa and taken lessons. So I continue to add on to the name that is me, you know. Like I said, names happen. Even nicknames are part of our rites of passage.
Yes.
So you know, I was around 15 years old or 14 years old when I changed my name to Infinite Mind. I became a member of the Nation of Gods and Earths. So my first name was Infinite Mind, God Allah. And people called me Infinite. From then, I also, you know, did some research in the Arabic, and as I was reading Quran, and I took on the name Rafiq. My name became Infinite Mind Rafiq Allah. And then when I gained a different kind of consciousness, I moved forward and studied in different communities. Of course, you learn about Africanness and what that's about, and who we all were before we were in America, which has a lot of influence on who we are today, whether people like to believe it or not. And And so then I changed my name then again. And like I said, Cthulhu came as a consequence of going through a different rites of passage with a different group of people. So as you can see, what I'm saying is like I committed to changing my name when I knew that my real name wasn't mine when I was 14 years old. But my names have been changing since. You know, even in South Africa, Skumbuzo, which means to remember where you come from. Yeah. It's another interpretation of Cthulhu, which also means follow your path.
Yeah. So for communities of color, especially African American, we've been called Negroes, African American, Black. What do those names mean to you, and why do you choose to be called African? Well, as in the song that Dead Prez put together, I am African, not African American. Why do you choose that?
I mean, for me, you know, the choice to become African was the antithesis of the identity of being an American, which came at the consequence of Africa and still the rape of Africa and the rest of the world. You know, this is the identity. Of course, at one point, it was probably progressive for us to be Negroes more than, you know, niggers, if I can say that on this radio station.
You can.
It was progressive to be a Negro at one point, and then it was also progressive to be an Afro-American, and it was also progressive to be Black. You know,
yes.
And so as we find our identity, that's what we're doing. I'm finding the most correct statement that's going to lead me to the root. I can't say that even though I can identify myself as an African, I haven't done the DNA testing that would lead me to the exact part of the continent in which I was snatched from. But I do know more correctly than me being an African American, which is a contradiction in terms.
Since we're on the topic of race, I wanted to talk about Dirty White Girl. It's a very provocative song. I get the drug analogy, but some of the lyrics, I don't want to catch no jungle fever, could lead one to assume something otherwise. But at the end of the song, there's a disclaimer. The concept of race has no scientifically proven biological or genetic validity. It is a social construct that has been used as a tool of oppression for centuries. I was hoping you could go into detail as to what was the intention behind the song.
But the song Dirty White Girl was is a 2013 anti-drug message.
So it's mostly just about...
It's the white lines, if you remember white lines from Grandmaster Flash and them.
Yeah.
It's a 2013 version of it. It's totally about identifying the things that are bad for our body with the whiteness and the whitening of the world.
All right.
It's definitely not about race or a statement about anybody's skin color, black or white women or white men. It is totally the analogy that equates things that are white with our health as the worst things that go into our body are the white stuff. You know,
yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah, the bleach.
The Molly, white sugar, the white flowers. You know, but we talk about it in a creative and colorful way, and I think that's why we say no jungle fever. But we take it as a health analogy more than
mostly
a race
joke.
Analogy, you know, but there is a question about relationship and race, the relationship of race today, which that song wasn't an attempt to cope. It was more an attempt to talk about health from a perspective that put race in the analogy. You know,
Since we're on the subject of race and whiteness, I know you're from Brooklyn. I don't know if you still live here, but the name of my show, it's called A Moment with the Token in a Post-Gentrified Brooklyn. The issues I want to talk about are the gentrification, the whitening of a lot of colored neighborhoods like Bed-Stuy or areas like that. What do you think of that? Like, what does gentrification mean for communities of color?
I mean, obviously, the gentrification is the great black flight. You know, it used to be the white flight. You know what I'm saying? Now, because what capitalism needs us to do is get closer, at least get the people get people closer to the means of production. That's what it's about. That's what capitalism is about today. At one point, the luxury of capitalism was to be able to work in a place and then to be able to go home and go far to the suburbs and be able to, you know, escape that life. And the inner city was left to the workers, who were more close to, you know, we could get close to our 9-to-5 and be there even before our bosses did. But nowadays, the luxury of capitalism wants people to be closer to where that means the production is, and that's why you see, you know, the gentrification of Brooklyn and the way it is, and the whitening of what's happening, you know, throughout America. That didn't just happen here, you know, yeah. Chicago, it's Dallas, Miami, it's everywhere, you know what I mean? So, you know, at the end of the day, I think that's the phenomenon that we're seeing, and we have to break it down economically. You know, some people want to break it down, based on, you know, oh, they hate black people, so they're moving us. No, there's a strategic reason why black people are being bused to the suburbs and being relocated out of these communities, which have been hundreds and hundreds of years historically black. So, you know, so, I mean, we'll see. You know, we can only see where this is going. You know what I'm saying? Time will only tell.
So what do you think the reason is? You mentioned just a couple of seconds ago, there's a reason why we're being pushed to certain areas.
Yeah, I mean, gentrification is a code word for, it's just another strategy for war. I mean, the same way they use the words like embargo, you know, or boycott, you know, these are political strategies. Gentrification is a political strategy, you know, like I said, and it's to get the affluent, the ruling class, closer to the means of production and control these communities, which right now in the inner city is controlled by the working class. You know, so if there was a battle to get to the resources, they would have to battle with us to do it. So that's the reason. You know, is to be able to for control, is population control.
Yeah. Talking about politics, your song. How do you think the Black Panthers has influenced you in your music, in your life? When you were in college, you joined the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement. How do you think those experiences shaped who you are?
Well, those experiences have given me the glasses that I'm looking through right now, the proverbial glasses that I'm looking through at this very second. You know what I mean? Like, I'm able to see the world through a political scope that answers questions to me about why things like Trayvon Martin happened, or why, you know, a crisis in Europe is going down the way it is, or even why we have a black president. So I'm able to come to conclusions about these things through a political education that I received that was comprehensive of what happened during the 1960s and the turbulence and the rise of the most powerful political movements that we've had, the Black Panther Party and so forth, and up until now. And so I'm a composite of these experiences. And those teachers became my teachers, and yes, up until now, I am who I am because of that, you know, because of my schooling and intensive political studies through the Uhuru Movement, Omali Ishitella, based in St. Petersburg, Florida, where we started, not down in Tallahassee, and continuing. So, like, you know, that's what I'm about. That's how I can see the world through the scope that I'm, and of course the lens is constantly changing. But with this as a foundation, a great foundation of political education, I can go forward knowing that I don't have to depend on the New York Times or MTV or somebody like that to give me a clear political perspective.
Yeah. Well, during, I guess, harder times for communities of color, I think it was easy for us to gather together and unite and do something about it. Why do you think nowadays it's much harder for communities of color, especially youth, to gather together and do something? I mean, the death of Trayvon Martin, I think, has gathered some people together to rally, but why do you think there's not really a constant force, like, maybe not something as radical as the Black Panthers, but something gathering community together to just work together? Am I clear on that? Are you clear on that question?
Yeah, I think basically because I don't think we've had the spark. I think the continuation of our movement has everything to do with the conditions that we live in. Yes, we're in emergency times and all of that, but I know we're in emergency times, but I don't think we've been able to sum it up. You know, our movement has not benefited from a continual resistance. There's been a broken resistance, and in between that, you know, the media has done a job in continuing to inundate us with things that make what our movement less important to us in our lives. Mm-hmm. They want to make it seem like the struggle to get food, clothes, and shelter is priority, you know, takes priority and precedence over that stuff. And I mean, of course, in many ways it does. People can say, well, how am I going to eat and put food on my table or start to protect myself from the police? But in reality, we're not protecting ourselves from this. But the illusion, you know, the great veil of the media has really done a great job in keeping us quiet, keeping us, in a pretty much paralyzed position. And I think that's why, like, our movements come in short spurts. But I do believe that as we continue to go through crises like the ones that we're seeing, economically in our community, you know, where people, you know, hell, in the Bronx, you know, they're Africans and so-called Latinos who exist off, you know, less than $2 a day. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, that's the same as in, you know, so-called third world countries and places, you know. So, you know, as these conditions persist, I do think you'll see a continuation of our, you know, movements happening. There are people in pockets who are doing fantastic things. Like I just mentioned, the Bronx. You got, you know, Rebel Diaz Arts Collective, those brothers from Rebel Diaz and sisters who are doing fantastic things. So, like, I just think it is a matter of time before that connection clicks and we stay. You know, we can't recreate the Black Panther Party. We can learn from what the Black Panther Party gave us. We can't recreate it. But there are things that we can do to make these conditions right. And there's some good people in the right places doing some stuff. In Tallahassee, Florida, where me and Stig met up, there's a group called the Dream Defenders who have been occupying the state capitol building for the last 10 days. You know, in order to change the stand your ground policies and laws throughout the state. I mean, there's people who are engaged, but just in many different ways. So, you know, who knows? You know, who knows? Who knows where we're in? You know, I just think when the conditions are ripe, then the leadership will emerge. You know.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much. I think what I like about Dead Prez and your movement is that it's not just talk. You guys aren't just talking about the issues. Stickman founded the RBG, Red, Black, and Green Fit Club. I don't know if you can talk a little bit about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love to talk about Fit Club. You know, yeah. Basically, you know, it comes as a consequence of our initiatives around health, and it, which, you know, began with our album. I mean, and many people know we've been trying to be healthy for years. On our first album, the tune "Be Healthy" came as like really a motivation for us, especially Stick, who, and many people know the story. He developed gout, you know, from not eating healthy, which he then, you know, sent what it helped him to develop a more healthy lifestyle. He even opened the door to, like, other, you know, alternative health opportunities. So we've been talking about, like, eating raw foods and living foods and veganism and vegetarianism.
I don't eat no meat, no dairy, no sweets, only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. I'm from the old school, my household smell like soul food, bruh. Curry falafel.
Stickman, are you on the air? No fish, no
Peace. How y'all?
Hi, how are you?
Super duper.
Thank you so much for joining us. Oh, is it?
Indeed, man.
Well, I hope you're keeping dry.
I am staying light, man. What up, M? What up with it?
Hey, I'm happy to have you guys both on the air. We were just talking about RBG Fit Club. I don't know if you could. I don't know if you could jump in and just tell me, like, why you started it and what pushed you and.
Cause I'm a gangster.
All right. Revolutionary, nah, but gangster.
Because healthy is the new gangster. It's a passion. You know, from experience, from seeing my family members go through diabetes, a heart attack, drug addiction, my own lifestyle of you know, getting over different things, my martial arts training, running, yoga, meditation, all the alternative things, acupuncture, all the things that life has introduced me to as, you know, counteract, you know, this disease of life, you know, on the capitalism, oppression, and everything that we live under. And you know, I realized that there's some simple ways to empower ourselves, you know, and our health and vitality, that don't require a total overthrow of the whole system. And we can, things that we can do today. And I've seen a change in my own life, a transformation, and I wanted to extend that platform to introduce people to some simple things that, you know, maybe could make a difference in the short term for people as well, and the long term.
Yeah. I was just looking through the site the other day, and I saw your, I was looking through your wife's site, actually, Afia, and I was looking at the Hood Health Handbook. I didn't get a chance to actually order and see it, but I just, maybe you could tell me a little bit more about that, because I thought that was such a, that's something that we need in our community, especially with corner stores being like the main access to food.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, the Hood Health Handbook that Afia has on our site is a book created and compiled by a friend of ours, Supreme Understanding. And it's, that book is basically teaching at a basic level the same principles, you know, that my wife does with natural.com, same thing with RBG Fit Club, is trying to make health information accessible in the language and where people are at, you know what I mean? So the Hood Health Handbook is like a super encyclopedia of things related to everything from like what's in corner store and why it's not healthy for you, or how can you get healthier intake, and what does that look like, you know, how you get your greens and produce if you live in a food desert, you know. It's all kind of different information in there. I got a couple articles in there, my wife has a couple articles, so, you know, but Supreme Design Publishing put that book out, man. We just support like-minded comrades.
Yeah. This is a question for both of you guys. When did you start to eat healthy? What was that push? Was it just seeing your family being unhealthy from diabetes, or was it like a change when you became Rastafarians? I'm just going off of your lyrics from No Way But The Way. You kind of mentioned when you became Rasta, that's when you became a vegan. Was that the first push to get healthy, or was there something before that?
Well, I'll start. For me, my first notion of health related to food was from Malcolm X, reading his biography in like ninth grade, and he was when he talked about the pork, and you know what I mean, and how it affects high blood pressure and all the different things in our community. And I was like, wow, I don't know why I never knew that, you know?
Yeah.
So from that spark, I was like, that opened my mind to be curious about how does a different food affect us. And, you know, me personally, I came down with something at 21 called gout in my legs.
Okay.
And from my diet of a lot of meats and stuff with uric acid, smoking mad blunts all the time, drinking alcohol, and overdoing it. And I came down with a condition called gout. And my wife, Afia, she, you know, she's a nutritionist now. She was studying to become a holistic healer at the time. And she basically said, we're not going to put you on medicines and go through that whole doctor route. We can do this alternatively through your diet and through changing, you know, that. So that was my glimpse of it was through Malcolm mentioning about pork, and I stopped doing that. But my wife and the healing, seeing my own self heal from gout with no medicine, was the full transformation. I became a vegan for many years, and today I'm a pesca vegan. But you know, and so that was it for me. My wife, and thanks to her.
Yeah. Okay. How do we increase knowledge, access to things like, you just said it was after you read the autobiography of Malcolm X, that's when you learned about, you know, maybe I should cut out pork and start eating healthier. Like, how do we increase that access to knowledge in communities of color?
Oh. Right on. Well, M, if you want to chime in, I'll say we have to be, as artists, as teachers, as parents, as MCs, as every, you know, graffiti artists, whatever, barbershops, everywhere, we have to take the time to study, and then we have to share it in the work that we do. And then, you know, in our communities, we'll have more exposure to these things because we're sharing it with each other, and we're using our platforms to circulate that information.
I think those are great words to end on. Thank you for joining me in this conversation on race relations, health, wealth, and everything in between. Just one last thing before you leave. Can you give us a drop as our listeners prepare to tune off but never tune out of the radio?
Hey, RBG Love, RBG Love. This is M1 right here. This is Sticky Icky. Healthy is the new gangster, and you listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Oh, my gosh.
President. Let's go.
Thank you so much for this. You have to go. My name is Kathleen Sherry, and this was A Moment with the Token in a Post-Gentrified Brooklyn. I'm not going to be able to do that.